the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program.
Let's do it. So yeah, Wendy's, Joey, Wendy's. They want to go where no fast food company has ever gone before.
I love this. This is a great idea. It's not a great idea.
Well, it's capitalism, right? They could do what they want and people could vote with their wallets. And for people who are unaware what the heck I'm talking about, they have plans to go ahead with something where people are describing as surge pricing. And they're going to be going ahead with this in 2025. But Wendy's is not calling it surge pricing. They're calling it dynamic pricing. So it's just semantics. Anyways, they say they're going to take advantage of their digital menus that they have, and they're going to be adjusting the prices based on the demand. And this is similar to how other companies like Uber or Lyft do things, where, you know, in times when things are very, very in huge demand, Uber and Lyft cost way, way more than other times of the day.
Oh, yeah.
And if this works for Wendy's, you got to think about this, because they're trailblazing here. And if it works for them and they can somehow increase their profitability, it's just a matter of time before somebody else follows suit, right? If somebody is proving that it works and you can make more money doing it, why wouldn't another company do the same thing?
Yeah.
And now, remember, the CPI, I'm going to go into the weeds here. Remember, the CPI, we always question the validity of it, how truthful it is to represent.
Yeah, but how to put it.
And even if you're trying your level best to figure out the price increases from month to month, year to year, it's fucking challenging to figure that out, to put in the basket of goods, all this shit. Now you got to throw in dynamic pricing from fucking Wendy's into this. It's going to make calculating the CPI even more challenging moving forward. But all this goes to show you is that the fast food industry, it's going to go through a lot of modernization moving forward, because next up, there's going to be robots replacing workers.
Yeah.
And it's already happening on a small scale, but on a larger scale, this could easily happen. And well, there could be some wholesale changes taking place in this industry. The end result here is you're going to have a heck of a lot of people probably that are going to be out of work. And well, Wendy's is probably going to make a heck of a lot more money due to this dynamic / surge pricing. If you don't like it, you could vote with your pocketbook. Don't go there. Go somewhere else at the time that they drive up the prices. But I'm curious to see how this plays out, because if it does well, like I said, it's going to be copied over and over again by every fast food company out there.
So they walked it back, right? So they're not going to go through with it, at least for now, under this whatever, you know, naming this, and this nomenclature is not going to be what they use. You're right. They're already calling it dynamic pricing when really it's surge pricing. The thing that makes Uber's surge pricing unique and, in my opinion, valid as a strategy is that when more and more people are asking for rides and there's no drivers out there, you have to raise the cost to the user to both discourage riders, which they're not going to do, but encourage off the app drivers to get on the app and start picking people up. This is the supply and demand. Okay, I get this. I understand this. Everyone's seen the, equilibrium curves. Everyone's taking like a, you know, base level economics course has seen that. That's what this is. For Wendy's, I'm unclear on why they would need surge pricing. Like, just because they are selling too many hamburgers that day and they maybe think they can get a bit more money for the hamburger and they decide to add a couple cents to the price of the hamburger. I'm not sure. It's an interesting idea out of Wendy's, of course, because, you know, everyone is driven by profits and they want to make as much money as possible. I get that. It's fine. No big deal. But I don't think you need it. And I think the customer base would be pretty upset about that. At least I would think that if the customer base had two brain cells to rub together, because I cannot imagine that anyone who goes to a Wendy's and sees the price of a, you know, double Dave burger or whatever they're selling over there. What do they call them over there? Quarter pounder, half pounder. Is that Wendy's? I think it is, right?
Quarter pounders is McDonald's.
So what does Wendy's call their burgers?
Don't they have like the Dave burger or something? Or is that old?
I don't know. Let's check it out. We got to find out what they're called, Wendy's burgers.
They're squares.
Yeah.
Right?
Items at Wendy's. Okay, let's see. What's the normal burger? I'm gonna realize right away that we should have known this and we didn't. Here we go. This is good business on air here. Looking at the Wendy's menu. Stay hungry, my friends. Hamburgers. Wow, they got a lot of stuff here. Croissants. Oh my God. Oh, this is the Baconator. The Dave's single, Dave's double, Dave's triple. Okay, the single, Dave's, double,
yeah,
triple.
So that's the one.
Yeah. So, like, if you decide that too many people are buying the Dave's triple and you raise the price 20 or 30 cents, I don't think a lot of people who are in line at Wendy's are going to leave the store over 30 cents. You know what I mean? I'm pretty sure they're not. They might do buy now, pay later instead to keep the, you know, good times rolling maybe or something, but I don't think they're going to leave the store. And so I do expect them to do this at some point, because people who go to fast food restaurants, generally speaking, are not going there to save money. They're going there to satisfy a, you know, salt sugar craving cycle that's going to drive them into type 2 diabetes in an early grave on their way to, you know, on their way to a, you know, difficult decade with he's like salt and sugar problems with a couple of kids who are out of shape. I don't know.
The buy now, pay later option, I think it's brilliant.
They're not going to do that.
No, as a consumer, it makes total sense. How could they repossess after you eat it? At that point, bankruptcy, and you're laughing. Right? Take advantage while you can.
On that loan for the hamburger. I don't know what, I don't know why you would do this. Yeah, well, why would you not do this, right? And you know what else, Len? Years ago on this show, I think we probably talked about it, but I can't remember if it was 2020 or 2021 the first time I saw this. You know, grocery stores have had these digital tags for a long time already, right? I'm sure you, listener, viewer, in your hometown, right? If you're in a semi-major Canadian metro and you have a store like Metro or Fortino's or any of the Loblaws chains, they have digital tags now on the store or on the items in the store on the shelves. I think that there's something to that, and I think that food producers know sort of intrinsically where things are going in a way that maybe retail consumers don't, and maybe also governments don't or pretend not to. And so they use those tags as a way to be able to update prices quickly. Think about how many times they would have had to change the tags in every single Fortino's for the price of eggs or milk, right?
If it's a digital one, then they could just easily do it.
They do it on a dime. Exactly. Yeah. Right. They do it every day if they want. And soon, mm-hmm. I think there's potential that will happen, because as we just mm-hmm. talked about earlier in the show, the cost of your lettuce is going to go up when the price of oil goes from 72 to 82, and then it's going to go up again from 82 to 85, and up again from 85 to 90, and 90 to 95, and so on and so on and so on. And they need those tools in place to be able to do that. Now, politicians, I think at that point will say, hey, look, this is surge pricing. It's unfair. But I would say that it's anything but. I would say that they were prepared for a scenario that I think a lot of people saw coming, including people who listened to and watched this show and you and I, and they ignored it for the most part, the people who should have been taking care of it. And now you're kind of seeing the consequences. I don't think that Wendy's is going to be alone in this. I think you're right. And I think that you're going to see more and more of this, because it's sort of what the culture, the economic culture at the moment demands, right? You have to be agile in your pricing. And you see this anyways, by the way, in a lot of higher-end restaurants. If you go to a high-end restaurant and order fish, what do you usually see as the price?
It's going to be very, very expensive.
No. What do you see? There's no price.
It says price.
It says market. Price. It says market.
Or price. And, like, yeah. But
so you pay based on what the cost to bring that fish in or what the fish is. You're going to see this more and more. This is not new. It's just that now everyone is subjected to it for everything because of the backdrop. That's all. It's not going to change.
It's not back. This is just advancing, like, the way things are done. It's just the next level. It gives them the opportunity to adjust prices based on demand, and they can maximize it.
Let them. Yeah.
And you know what? Capitalism hopefully will solve
it's better
everything.
For me, because I don't think a lot of people are buying like nothing but ground beef and eggs. So hopefully I can get a decent deal on ground beef and eggs. I don't know.
I'm hoping capitalism will sort it out, because there'll be competition and people will, like I say, vote with their pocketbooks, and the ones that provide the best value is going to get the most money and they'll get rewarded, and others should copy suit. And that's just the way things go. Like, that's just an open market. Yeah. But something that's not
watching this price really so closely, 68,560. Okay. Do the next story. I'm going to unplug and plug my block hawk back in. You can watch me trouble.
See, I chirped him enough to finally get this. I just unplug it and plug it back in. It should work at the next cycle. Anyways, banks are safe, people. Remember, I'm telling you this, banks are safe. Actually, probably it's not the case, because a Federal Reserve policy warns on the possible financial sector risks with respect to banks. No fucking shit. If you look at companies like New York Community Bancorp, for instance, and, you know, if you look at them, you can confirm that there are at least cracks within the financial system. And for those unaware, shares of this regional bank took another 20% shit just this past week when it was reported due to that they had bad quarterly or earnings report. People didn't like that, of course. And a lot of this is being attributed to exposure to the commercial real estate market in the state of New York, which has been a losing ticket as of late. But back to the Fed report. Remember the BTFP program? Well, that is ending, right? That's coming to an end. And that was put in place to shore up the banking sector after several collapses last year. With this program ending, the banks are now back in the spotlight as their safety net has been removed. So big companies, if you look at like the JP Morgans, the Bank of America's, they're all doing well when you look at their stock price. If you take a look at their stock price, it seems that everything's going okay. But look at the regional banks. There are a lot of them that are taking a kick to the nuts. Their stock price has tanked significantly over the past year, sometimes in the past week, as I was mentioning for the New York Community Bank Corp. So these regional banks, we talk about it enough. This is the canary in the coal mine. These are the ones that are going to go tits up first. They have the least amount of capital that they could deal with any problem at times. And so they're going to have to get either bought up or the Fed comes in and bails them out or some combination of the two. But look out, because there's going to be some major fucking bank failures this year. BTFP coming to an end. They have nothing left. The exposure is fucking real. They have some financial risks. And even the Federal Reserve, this policy report fucking underlines that there's some problems here. This is going to be a fun year to watch what happens.
Okay, so Zero Hedge put a story out on the same topic that we covered 2 weeks before them, when we talked about the difference in credit, what is the name of this program or this figure? It was like the distressed credit, basically. And the Federal Reserve Economic Data website has the banks broken down into two categories. One are the big boys, one are the little boys. Okay. And the big boys were seeing like a 3.5% sort of delinquency or distress rate in their credit products, stuff like credit cards, car loans, things of those that nature, retail loans, let's say. 3.5% is not that much, and it's a lot lower than it was in 08. And there's all these other, you know, metrics that point to this being up of something to keep an eye on, but nothing to panic about. But then if you look at the regionals are higher than they were in 08 at about 7%. And we talked about this and said, look, the regionals are really a thing that holds the banking system together, because a lot of people are looking to get loans for homes and businesses and whatnot in the United States. They use regionals. They don't use the big banks. There's a lot more competition there in terms of financial vehicles and financial institutions than there is here. And people take advantage of it. They don't always go to the big banks. With BTFP ending and loan losses looking like they're going to start piling up for the regionals, you are actually going to see, I think, Len, you know, this thesis that people had a little while ago that you and me talked about briefly, but I don't think really dove into. A lot of mergers between the big banks and little banks, a lot of buy-ups and scoop-ups.
I've been mentioning this for a long time.
We didn't really dive that deep into it, but now it looks almost unavoidable, does it not?
For sure. If you look at the number of banks that are operating right now, and you look at this over the past few years, and you look at year over year, decade by decade, the number of banks have been going down significantly over the past 30, 40 years. Mm-hmm. And what happens is through consolidation. Bigger bank buys smaller bank, or two smaller banks merge to become bigger bank. That's what essentially happens. It's just the customers still need to be served, but they're served now by whoever is going to be owning the corporation moving forward. That's exactly it. You're going to have a lot of these smaller banks that are going to be bought up or merged, one of the two. That's the reality. This has been going on for a long time. And all you're going to have in the end is consolidation between a few big banks. It's going to take a lot of time to get there, but it's trending towards that direction.
Yeah, I'm keeping an eye on the BTFP thing. I think that's a huge it's a signal that things are not going that well when you end that program and a lot of banks have trouble. This is another thing I think that's like not priced in. How many people in TradFi were talking about how backwards the BTFP program was when it was released a year ago, when it started a year ago? Wasn't that many. People were happy about it in a lot of cases. We needed to do this to prevent a wider contagion, blah, blah, blah. You know, now it's ending. We'll see. Bitcoin had a rip when that program launched, right? When we started to see SVB and other regionals wobble and fail in some cases, at least in one case, one major case. Let's see what it does this time. I mean, we're pushing 69,000 here. We're very close. The floor on Bitcoin right now is 70,000, let's say, to make it an even number. The last time the Federal Reserve did QE cuts, bailouts for banks, et cetera, and businesses was COVID. The price of Bitcoin was 5,000, 3,000, something like that, you know, during that big COVID crash.
Yeah,
it made it up around that price. Made it up to 70, right? That's what, a 20x-ish?
20x from now, we're past a million.
You know, might be time to deploy, lads, as they say. Hard not to be all in when all this stuff is taking shape on the horizon. And it's not like you haven't seen it before, right? I think one of the things that people forget is that markets react in a way that seems irrational sometimes, because the gap between like what was going on 15, 20 years ago and then it happening again now meant that investors aged out or died or were no longer managing money or were no longer employing the same strategies, right? They became defensive and started doing 60-40 instead of doing equities, for example, or stuff like that. Now, the gap between the crises is what, 3 years? Like, that's if you count COVID. If you just look at the regionals, it's like less than a year right now. You know what I mean? Like, everyone remembers what happened. They know that the options are either failure, merger, or bailout. They remember what happened to Bitcoin last time. Come on. Come on. It's not that hard to figure this out, right? You're going to wind up with people who make the right choice this time on the retail side. I think a lot of people are doing it. You look at the Bitcoin price, everyone kind of sees the writing on the wall, right? The implication is that everyone remembers, and that memory, you know, wasn't there 30 years ago, 40 years ago, or even in 08 wasn't there, right? And now it's there, and it really does matter. You know, the communication strategy and the way that these guys operate for a long time relied on stuff like that, and that's gone. That cushion is gone.
What else could be said? Let's move on. Talk about U.S. credit card debt. We talk about this very frequent. And well, the reason why I'm bringing it up yet again is because we hit another all-time high with respect to that. It looks like Bitcoin's going to hit an all-time high, and well, the U.S. credit card debt is we're getting close. Adrian, we got to stay on this
68.5 here.
We got to stay on for a little while longer, I think. We'll talk about some NHL 94. So what's going on here is that we have 1.13 trillion. That is now being reported in credit card debt in the United States. $1.13 trillion. Let that sink in. In Q4 2023, there was a sizable jump in credit card balances. And just in Q4 of 2023, it increased some $50 billion. That's a 5% increase. Mm-hmm. And of note, during that period of time, we had the Amazon Prime Day, we had Black Friday, Cyber Monday, and Christmas shopping. So there was a lot of buying opportunities where people were doing it and funding it with their credit cards. So looking at this, I'm wondering how many people out there that are just one big car repair bill away from being wiped out.
Tons.
Who's going to be the ones that are going to be the bag holders here? Well, immediately, it's going to be the people that issued the credit. So it's going to be a credit card or a bank. But ultimately, it's going to be us. If you look down the line, they don't hold it in, you know, for a very long period of time. Eventually, they give it up and we take it. Now, I'm going to go a little bit further here. How much debt out there is on credit cards that is MasterCard and Visa? And I'm wondering, at what point are they going to be suffering hard? If it's 10% of the cardholders decide not to pay back their bills, is it 20%? I don't know what the number is. But they can't sustain a lot of people out there saying, we're not going to pay back our credit. What happens to these companies? What happens to Visa or MasterCard if they can't function because they don't have any capital to function? This would have drastic impact on our economy because we're driven off this credit debt. Businesses can't operate without credit. Maybe 30, 40 years ago, yeah, but not now in 2024. Something could happen here. A domino could fall that would drastically change the economy as we know it. I think we are very close to that. I'm looking at the size of this credit card debt, and it's just an indication that we are much closer to the end than we are to the beginning.
Huge bubble. I just looked it up really quick here with Copilot. Canadians spent in 2022 $11.7 trillion. The consumer debt number in Canada in the second quarter of 23 was $2.4 trillion. So to give you an idea of how much of that is credit card debt, let's say half of it, maybe a third of it. It's a big number still. That's just Canada. If we look in the States, you know, you probably 10 times that number, right? For the population, you're talking $10 trillion, right? That's a lot of outstanding debt. If you factor that number into the GDP, right, which you should be doing, I think the GDP counts credit card spending. Last I checked, you know, how much GDP is really just debt-based spending, both on the government level and on the retail level? Is the answer all of it? Close to all of it?
No, I don't say all of it. It's a heck of a lot.
It's not, but it's a lot. But it's a lot. It's a lot, yeah. Right? And so that it's like you said, it's scary. Any so like a little bit of a shake or wobble, or a default, or like a cascade of defaults. You know, if everyone has to get their Tesla 3 battery changed at the same time, you're in a bit of trouble, I think, right? So, yeah, it's not a good situation, that's for sure.
Want to do some notable stories north, or you got other things you want to talk
about? No, let's go north with the notables here. Yeah, what do you got?
Well, the Canada Pension Plan, the CPP. Well, we got wind this past week that the Canada Pension Investment Board, they sold off some properties. And this includes a pair of Vancouver towers, a business park in Southern California, and a redevelopment project in Manhattan. And all of these properties were heavily discounted. And notably, the one in New York was sold off for the price of just $1. And I would hope that they got that dollar and they bought Bitcoin. But if you look at it, bull Bitcoin has a $200 minimum. So they have to sell 200 of these properties before they can make a buy. Anyways, that $1 sale was to Boston Properties, Inc. And that was one of the partners involved in that real estate deal. And they agreed to assume the CPP Investment Board's share of the project's debt. So they didn't just get that for a buck. They took on the debt load as well. Now, if you look at the Canada Pension Plan, we talk about the solvency of this moving forward. As of December 31st, 2024, they have net assets of
2023.
You're right. Sorry.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
This is the future. They have net assets of $590 billion, right? That's how much they have. This is Canadian, by the way. The previous quarter, they ended at $576 billion. So that's a 2.5% increase in Q4. Which doesn't seem all too bad, but I mean, you think about it, all the people that are drawing upon the CPP and more people are going to be drawing upon the CPP.
Yep.
It just makes you wonder how much longer before this number will start to go down and go down continuously quarter over quarter. They said that the quarter as a whole, they made a net income of $19.3 billion, but 4.7 was outflows. So that's how many people are drawing from the CPP every month. So that's going to be going up more and more. So yeah, I'm looking at this, the sale of the properties, then they're just getting rid of these assets at a fire sale price. There's a lot that's going to be going on. Yeah, they could potentially start buying Bitcoin. They could put a very small allocation towards Bitcoin and hope that carries the rest of their portfolio. But another thing that to consider too is I went on Google and I just typed in something about CPP, that CPP holdings, or I can't exactly remember what I put in, but it was very benign. Yeah. But one of the results that came up from Google was, is CPP going to be around in 30 years? So clearly people have questions about how solvent CPP is going to be moving forward. And a lot of people rely on it. It doesn't pay a heck of a lot, but a lot of people that are retired, they rely on this to help pay their bills. Oh man, imagine working your whole life paying into this and there's nothing there at the end. That'd be a travesty, but it's a reality. It's a possibility.
I want to show you something that ran during the NBA All-Star weekend. Since we're on the topic, it's interesting that you mentioned CPPIB and their advertising talking about, you know, whether they'll be around in 30 years. I always find it strange that these, you know, mega institutions, things that we're told are like, you know, beyond just reliable, they are the pinnacle of, you know,
they're the Bear Stearns of the pension world.
Yeah. Okay. That's one way to put it. Yeah. So look at this. This ad ran during NBA All-Star weekend.
These Canada pension plan benefits are secure, thanks in part to CPP investments. Huh. We're also doing the same for his son-in-law.
The CPP really wants me to know that they're solvent so much that they're running ads about how good their solvency is on NBA All-Star weekend. Nothing to see here.
His Canada pension plan benefits are secure.
It's just repeating it with the beginning again.
I don't know, Len. What do you make of that? Why are they running advertisements? You know, it's really weird that they're running advertisements. And then what is the name of that? You know, what's the acronym for the bank account protection, savings protection? Deposit insurance. It's deposit insurance, registered deposit insurance. CDIC. Yeah. And I look at these two things and I'm like, that's, you know, very bizarre. If I start, you know, tweeting nonsense about, I don't know, the RCMP is about to fall or something like that, the RCMP is not going to start running ads about how they're not about to fall and the RCMP is as strong as they, like, they're not, just not going to do it. But these guys suddenly are both running ads about the legitimacy of the service and the backstop they're providing to Canadians. That's not a bit weird to you? It's a bit weird to me.
The writing is on a wall. why should they do this?
Yeah, I just don't know. Like, why would you ever? It's just weird.
They have enough capital that they could pay out their obligations for, you know, decades to come. But they're doing this as a way to increase people's confidence in the product. People obviously that are having concerns or questions about it, that they have to do this. They have to spend time and money to produce and put out and pay for the 15 people that watched the NBA All-Star to watch this on TV. So they had to, you know,
I don't even know why I had it on, honestly. I wasn't really watching it. The dunk contest sucks every year anyway. It's fucking terrible.
It used to be better. I'm not sure if you saw that one dunk contest.
The Levine Aaron Gordon dunk contest in like 2016 was the best one ever. It was in Toronto. That was the best dunk contest of all time.
There's one where they had Michael Irvin. They had
Michael Irvin, the receiver.
They had a bunch of NFL guys come in and do it. And I watched a clip of that. It was fucking awesome. Even Bo Jackson dunked the ball, of course. And it was just fucking great to see. That's what I want to see. I think Griffey was in there too. So I think they even had some baseball.
Did see that clip of Ken Griffey Jr. Throw down a dunk. Now that you mention that, that does tickle my memory a little bit.
Yeah.
Mark in the chat saying we have to. Keep talking. We're at a key resistance level here.
we only have so much material.
We still got 15 minutes. We can just wing it for 15 minutes.
Fuck, how much work? I'll talk really slow. So yeah, on the topic of pensions, CBC, they published an article, and this was written by one Mr. At least I think it's a Mr. Benjamin Shingler. And his piece mentions that the Canada's largest pensions, not just the CPP, but collectively all the pensions within Canada, they have trillions of dollars under management. And he writes that they are not doing their part to move their equity away from fossil fuels. And he's writing that these investments are not aligned with climate goals.
I love this.
He says that other investment funds, like the New York City pension funds, for instance, and others in France and the Netherlands, well, they are ramping up their investments in renewable and also in green energy companies. Okay, that's fine. I just want to point out that pensions shouldn't be there to invest in ideologies. It should be trying to maximize the amount of money that they could pay to the people drawing from their pension plan. That's what they should be doing. If they tell me that they're going to invest all in defense, I'm not a fan of defense, but if it makes the most money, go right ahead. Because in the end, people that are part of that pension plan, they want to draw from it. They don't want to have a portion or a percentage of it. And because, you know, things didn't go well, we invested in, you name some shitty project, it just didn't pan out. Fuck that. I'd rather have them get the money. I don't care where it comes from. As long as it's legal, of course. They're not selling drugs.
I wouldn't even care. I honestly wouldn't even care if it was legal. I just want to
make sure. There you go. But if you could buy that stock on the stock market, it's there. It's available for sale. Anybody could buy. Anybody should be able to buy it. And if they want to buy that or an ETF that has that in the basket, fine. All the more power to them. So I just want to say, Benjamin Shingler, like, you're wrong, man. You're wrong. Yeah. It's not about ideology. It's about maximizing the amount of money that they can make for their pensioners. That is it.
Hard to believe that we're having this conversation at a time when pensions are coming under stress all over the world. The funniest thing about the CPP is that if you look across the border, every politician and commenter, you know, from Ted Cruz to Jeffrey Gunlock, okay, and everybody in between is talking about how the entitlement programs in the states are bankrupt and they're going to have problems meeting their requirements inside of 5 years or 10 years. You think Canada's any different? Canada's economy is not growing at all. The CPPIB, by the way, doesn't even invest in Canadian equities. Like, that's how bad things are here. So if you think that you're gonna have the luxury of telling the CPPIB to get out of fossil fuels and also be able to afford a bag of milk in retirement, I got bad news. It's not going to happen. You have to be able to choose one or the other. And for a lot of people, I think, you know, these luxury beliefs in stuff like, you know, green energy and responsible investing and DEI, great, man. If that's what you're into, fine. But when it comes time to either make ends meet or choose the luxury beliefs, everybody wants to put food on the table. And that's where we're going to land, I think, whether we get there sooner or later. Really just a matter of, you know, how many bumps in the road on the way to an obvious outcome for 99.9% of people.
Joey, your block clock is working again, whatever you did. I think you just unplugged and unplugged.
That's all I did, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Whenever I have a power outage, which is infrequent, by the way, it causes an issue with my block clock. It loses connection and it never connects again until I disconnect it. Unplug the power and plug it back in, and it works flawlessly at that point. Sometimes it goes months without coming off that, it just works. So I just want to give a plug to the block clock. It's a great product.
I want to ask a question here. Wayfaring. Okay. So I have to update my comments earlier. Wayfaring says he has not written a technical post. So he's written a post, but it's not a technical post. He also wants to know, and I'll put it to the listeners, the CBP blog, longer pieces less frequently or shorter pieces more frequently? He's going to tailor the piece here. So let me know in the chat or just tag Wayfaring on Twitter and tell him what you want.
Well, you know, because we don't have a list, like we have a list, but we don't send out a mailing list. Like we don't send out the emails. I don't think it really matters to people in the end. For the most part, if we have the mailing list, then they probably be more inclined to pick one or the other because we're not spamming them with our stuff.
Not yet anyways.
Please. They actively have to go to our website and read it. Yeah. So in that respect, I would prefer to see a longer piece, but
me that's too. Just my opinion. I like the longer ones. I'll tell them longer.
Well, no, let's not make an executive.
That's what I want to. Yeah, I'm making
this is democracy, man. If you guys want shorter pieces, if somebody wants to mail in a bunch of ballots to say that they want to have shorter pieces, who am I to say they're not fucking legitimate? Especially if they come in after the closing date.
We'll be counting them for 3 days, as we know that's the standard
for elections. And in other jurisdictions like El Salvador or Argentina, they could wrap up an election within fucking one evening. And over here, it takes days and days.
Let's do one more story and then I got to hit the toilet. I don't know how much this mic picks up, but I've been letting off some bangers here. So
I haven't heard.
Why don't we do one more notable North story and then we'll wrap it up.
Do you want to talk about the first time Homer?
I actually want to talk about this. So this program is being scrapped. Okay.
Yes.
And this is the CMHC program, I believe, right? Where, yes. If you're a first-time home buyer, the CMHC will take on a portion of your costs, and in return, you will be giving them a portion of your home. They will own a portion of your property. So you have some, CMHC has some, the bank has the rest, basically is the breakdown. Why was this program ever even started, Len? Well, who used this program? Obviously not that many people.
22,826, to be specific.
In how many years?
And I think it was 1 year, could be a little. Anyways, it was 100,000 people they were expecting to take advantage of this, but yeah, less than a quarter took advantage of it. Now, the question you're asking is who would be using this? The idea was for people that were priced out of the housing market, then they could have the government pick up the remaining tab and they would then be a partial. Essentially owning the home.
Okay, can we just discuss the sort of economic theory behind this proposal? Sure. If you're priced out of the market, okay, then that means the market is at a floor. Let's say the floor at the moment is X. Okay, this is the floor of the housing market.
I know where you're going. I totally agree.
But it needs to be said for posterity and for the record. Okay, if the floor of the market is X, okay, and the government says to you, you can only meet the requirements of getting in the housing market if the floor is Y, okay? And the gap between X and Y is 3%, let's say. Then the floor is going to move up because the government will always cover the gap between what you have and what you need to get in. That's the natural order of the market if you add this sort of perversion. And when you have that happen, what happens to the market then? It gets frothy. Everything moves up in price, right? And you price out more and more people, and then more and more people need the program. And before you know it, CMHC owns 20% of every property in the country that's been owned for less than 3 years or whatever the number is. Who knows? Then you start to talk about, okay, well, I'll just wait for a housing crash. We need a housing crash to get into the market. Well, not really, because if the crash comes, CMHC's underwater on all their loans. Banks are underwater on all their loans, and like they can't let that happen. So what do? They just keep raising the floor with programs like this. It doesn't work. This doesn't work. If I can do this from the basement, okay, from the yellow chair, and you can do this from the basement, okay, in the swivel chair, then why can't everyone else do this? Why don't these guys realize that they're just raising the floor artificially and costing people more money in the long term? What's the problem, right? I don't understand this. It's very difficult for me to understand how this program makes it through, you know, a number of different reviews and policy lookovers and red teams and things like this. Like, how does this happen? Where's the gap? Where's the gap in understanding here? I think this is pretty clear,
there's,
is it not?
Two things. There's politics and there's policy. Which side of this do you think it
falls under? Good politics is almost always bad policy, blah, blah, blah. I know.
And if you subscribe to that theory, then you can understand why this is going out there. So it's just a reality. So that was the idea behind it. It was going to inject.
Not to interrupt you. Narwhal has a good question in the chat here. I'll put it up for people who are on video. Is the government paying any of the mortgage, or is the homeowner paying the full mortgage?
No,
good question.
Homeowner, from what I understand, the homeowner pays for everything, and including maintenance, upkeep, and so they take all the shittiness that comes along with owning the house. The government will get a portion of it once you sell it, and so they're just there to help you get in. But once you get out, they're going to be asking for their handout, their slice of the pie. Whatever. This is coming to an end. It's as of March 21st. They are not going to be accepting any new or updated applications.
Yeah.
And there's going to be no approvals granted after March 31st. And the program, they said they had it budgeted $1.25 billion associated earmarked for this, but only $408 million, almost $409 million have been utilized. So in the grand scheme of things, a quarter-ish of the funding has been allocated to it. But in terms of the amount of applications, it's less than a quarter. So
yeah,
that's it, whatever. It's another program, come and go. And it's just a footnote in our history, it looks
just
like.
Just a footnote in history. That's it for tonight.
Well, we just stay on for a couple of, we're
68,503.
So if we stay on for another, I don't know, 3-4 hours, we should be there.
Who's gonna edit the fucking audio? My dog's probably taking a shit outside too. Fuck.
There's that one guy that we kind of know that does those long fucking videos, right? And it just goes on. It's like 6-hour videos. I'll tell you.
Oh yeah. I know who you're talking about. It's amazing what you can do if you're just high as a kite, probably. But if you're not, then you know, you're just talking to yourself sitting in front of a camera.
And you don't have, you know, you don't have any obligations or anything. Yeah.
It's a tough labor market, as they say. That's it. Good night and God bless. We'll see you.
Mark's chirping you, man. Go to the bathroom.
Mark's going off here. Get back to work. Corporate.
Let's do rotation, Mark. I'm going to take off for a bit. You come in for me. Joe, you and he rip for the next.
Oh, we're fucking out of here. Listen, hang on for all-time highs. If you're not stacking, you ought to be. And come back Wednesday for the interview. You'll like it with
Central.
Central, that's right.
I think
I want to say Decisive. Decisive is an old-school Toronto-based rapper, but it's not him. Anyway,
or D.
That's it, everybody. That's yeah. Take care. Comb your hair. We'll see you next time.
Don't be a cock.
Hold on, I gotta do all the streams here. Here we go. Save.
I think it does it automatically for Rumble. At least
I don't know. Me. Good night, everybody.
It's still going on.
Don't forget, everybody, lots of other stuff on CBP Media Network, including Two Whites and a Blue, me, Joey, my brother-in-law, Mike, and our friend Will talk about all the problems millennials are having with finance, romance, and just getting by. If you'd like CBP, if you like the NHL 94 podcast, I guarantee you'll like that one. Search for it, Two Whites and a Blue, anywhere you get your podcasts. We look forward to seeing you.